Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. For fabulous ideas and great savings, the winter sale is not to be missed. Now on, in-store or at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. Seventy-three years ago this coming Friday, an Aer Lingus plane left London Northolt, as it was then known. It was an airport near London. It was a regular exit and entry point from Collinstown, as Dublin Airport was known, to London. The Aer Lingus flight, it was a DC-3, which was a lot of people who know a lot about the Second World War would recognise that craft. And The plane took off at 5:25 in the afternoon, as I say, this coming Friday, 73 years ago, and it was due to land in Dublin at 10 minutes past 8, and unfortunately and tragically, it never arrived. So this Friday not only marks the anniversary of the crash, it marks the anniversary of the death of 23 Irish people. And it crashed in Snowdonia in Wales in difficult weather, to say the least, which we're having this week as well. Evelyn Belton Rooney. Evelyn, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
I know one of your relatives died. It was one of the 23. What are your family memories of it, Evelyn, please?
Yes, she was my aunt. She was born Evelyn Belton. And, of course, she was born and had passed away before I was born.
Of course,
so, I just know things that my family spoke about her, because they spoke about her as if she was still alive.
Okay.
The death went so hard on the family.
Because she was very young. She was only 26.
She was very young, yeah. She was just 28. She would have been 29 two days later.
Okay.
Yeah, she was born in 1923 in Rathcline. The townsland of Rathcline in Lanesborough, County Longford. And she was one of five children when she was born. Sadly, another one of the children died when they were about three.
Okay.
So there were two boys and two girls left in the family, and she was the youngest.
Okay, and from the family stories, what was she? Did she live here or in the UK? What was she doing on the plane?
No, she lived here. She went to school locally, and she left school quite early, about 16. She went to work in the local drapery store because that's what she wanted, fashion and clothing and things like that. She worked there for 5 or 6 years, and her older brother and sister were in Dublin. Mm-hmm. And, of course, they encouraged her to go to Dublin too. So she went to Dublin she secured a position in the Silk Mills Group. That was a fashion house in Dorset Street.
You're well-known. Silk Mills, yeah. In Dorset Street in Dublin, okay.
And
what was her role? What was her role there?
Well, I suppose she went as a sales assistant firstly, but then she was promoted to senior overseas fashion buyer. So she went abroad numerous times to Europe, to various fashion houses and cities, and also indeed to London for fashion shows to pick up the fashions for the following season.
And this happened, as I say, in 1952. Do you recall being told, Evelyn, and obviously I presume you're called after Evelyn.
Yes.
Do you recall being told how the family found out about the tragedy?
Well, as I say, I just recalled I wasn't born at the time. I was the firstborn female afterwards, hence I was called Evelyn Belton too, born into the same house in Rathcline.
Okay.
When the accident occurred, naturally, she was living in Dublin and her address was Dublin. So the word came to Dublin, to her brother, where she was living with her brother, Luke Belton.
Yeah.
And he, in turn, the following day, sent word down to Rathcline. But it was on the news at 10 o'clock that night that a plane had crashed. And my grandparents, especially my grandfather, listened to the news every day and read the paper every day. Yeah. And they did hear about the plane crash. And my grandmother said, imagine somebody will have to go and tell parents that their child has died, that a family member had died. Little did they know that they had somebody on board. because she travelled numerous times abroad. Now, I know most of the trips were only 4 or 5 days, but she really wouldn't tell them she was going, not to worry them. So the next day then, on the Friday, the word came to Rathcline that she had passed away. And my grandfather said, don't worry, they'll find her and we'll bring her home. That was their hope, that they, that she would be found and she would be brought home. So,
and did that happen, Evelyn?
Well, their prayers were granted. Yes, she was brought home.
Okay.
She was, well, all the bodies, of course, were, all the deceased were badly mutilated, naturally. But she was brought home on the Tuesday afternoon, the 15th of January. Her remains left, again, left Northolt.
Yeah, and people would, just for people, people would probably know Northolt because it's an RFA, an RAF base now, and it's used for all Royal flights, so to speak, RAF Northolt, as they call it. And
right.
It came, probably its biggest prominence, if I'm correct, was when Princess Diana's remains were brought back from Paris. That's where they were met by Prince Charles and the other members of the royal family, was on the RAF Northolt. But that was a civilian aircraft base or airport at that stage.
Yes.
So, you're, after 73 years, I know you want to keep the memory alive, but what else do you want to happen?
Well, we have been up the mountain to the crash site.
Okay.
My husband and myself went on the 60th anniversary.
Okay.
We got a guide and he brought us up. It took us a long time to get up the mountain,
yeah.
Boggy. And even though we went in the summer, it was still very wet and boggy.
Yeah.
And I'm sure it was extremely wet in February when the accident happened.
Yeah.
And we've been up numerous times since with Gavin Walsh, who has written a book about the actual crash or the trip. But there's a plaque up on the site that Aer Lingus put up.
Yeah.
Now, it's quite difficult to get. You have to go round about, and it's flat on the ground. You know, it would be nice if it was standing up or something, and maybe updated and maintained. You know, that it would be easier to see if other people went. And also, there is a mass grave in Carnarvon.
Okay.
And all the deceased that were not brought home to their own homelands, all their names are on it. But it just says on it, the list of names. It doesn't say what happened, where they died, or how they died. Or it just says the list of names and the 10th of January 1952. So if you went to that grave, you would not know what happened to all those people. In fact, local younger people think it was a coal mining accident.
Oh.
And there is no mention of those people that were on the plane that were brought home to their own homelands. You know, it would be nice if there was another stone or headstone at the side of it, remembering those people who were brought home.
Yeah.
You know, just to include them with the people that haven't been brought home to their own countries or their own places.
And was the cause of the crash ever, insofar as I know there's always a little bit of doubt about every crash, but was the cause of the crash ever discovered?
Well, there was a court of inquiry held, I think just after that, some months afterwards, but to my knowledge, the exact cause of the crash was not determined. I know the weather paid a major part in it. You know, poor visibility, rain and turbulence, and it was going over the mountain. So that was, I would say, a major part of the accident.
One report I see say the St. Kevin, as it was called, departed
Northolt
at 17:25. Last radio contact with the flight was around 19:15. When the flight requested a descent, obviously in towards Ireland. The request was granted by the Dublin controller, but the clearance was not read back by the DC-3 crew. So something catastrophic obviously happened. The probable cause, and again, nothing is sacrosanct, but the encountering of a powerful down current of air on the lee side of Snowdon, which forced the aircraft down into an area of very great turbulence, where through one or another of several possible causes, the pilot or pilots, there was two of them on board, very experienced, the pilots or pilots lost control.
Well, the, stating the weather was the most most probable. Yes, they had reached the Nepean landmark in Wales. Yeah. There were different landmarks, seemingly, for the pilots, and they had reached the Nepean landmark.
And then the whole issue of navigation in those days would be very, very different from today.
They didn't have the resources.
I presume it's primarily done by radio signal, which can be unreliable. Yeah. Cathal O'Donovan, stay there, Evelyn, please. Cathal, good afternoon.
Okay. Thank you.
Good
afternoon, Joe.
Who did you lose in this crash?
Yeah, I lost, rather like Evelyn there, an uncle, and he was Dr. Dan O'Donovan from Drama House in Lip.
Yeah.
7 miles from Skibbereen. And he went to the local school in Connachtscheagh, where his father and mother were teaching. His father was a principal there. And then when he went on for his secondary education, then he went on to Castleknock College in Dublin.
Okay.
And then for his third level, then he went on to UCC, where he qualified as a physician in 1917. So wasn't all work and no play there either in UCC, because he captained the UCC rugby team at that time. And then he took up a locum position in Roscarbery with Dr. Carney for a year or two, and then left and went to Cardiff and took up a partnership with the Dr. Hurley. Okay. And that Dr. Hurley, as it happened, was from his own neck of the woods. He was from Ballydevan, Clonakilty. And after that, then he moved on up to Manchester for a few years, to Salford. And he finally, at that stage of his life, settled in North London around the time of the war, where he set up his own practice. And after that, then he came back to Ireland in 1947. The NHS, the National Health Service in England, I think, was instituted at the time. And I don't know, obviously, too happy with what prevailed there, so he came back to Dublin and he set up his own practice in Terenure in Kimmage Road West. And then after that, then that was 1947, and then the crash happened in 1952. And on that particular occasion, he went across to England to visit some friends that weekend. He booked his ticket about 3 months in advance, and then what happened then, on the Thursday, the 10th of January, where the plane ploughed into the bog off the top of Snowdonia.
Yeah.
During the Blitz, I suppose, like a lot of other people at that time during the war, he would be out and about wherever there was problems, wherever people were needed help, and made his rounds to help to do whatever he could in his chosen profession.
And do you know how your family found out in those, as I say, 73, how the family found out about?
Yeah. Well, I was only 6 years of age at the time,
of course,
right? But my sister now was 11, and I had a brother at 8, right? And my sister actually there, Evan mentioned Gavin and Walsh there a while ago. My sister climbed Snowdonia in 2014 with Gavin.
Ah.
And I don't know now whether Evelyn was referring to the same plaque or not, but there is a stone standing. It's about 3 feet by 2 feet, and it simply depicts what happened on that day of the fatal crash.
Mm-hmm.
And the man that put that the efforts of the man who put that plaque up, that stone plaque, was a John Roberts,
right.
And he was the head ranger in Snowdonia.
Okay.
And when my sister landed in 2014 and had arranged to meet with Gavin Walsh, and they had arranged to meet with John Roberts, when they landed, they found that, unfortunately and tragically, John Roberts had died about 10 days earlier, where he had fallen from a ledge and he was a ranger in Snowdonia all of the years. Mm-hmm. And from the age of six, he used to go up on that day of the fatal crash with his father to Snowdonia to remember and to commemorate the people that were there.
Okay. And so, has the plane, I'll come back to you in a sec, Colm, has the plane ever, we're talking about the DC-3 crash, Aer Lingus EI-165 Dakota, yeah. Very, I was going to say popular, but it was one of the biggest carriers of one of the biggest types of plane operating, because it operated in the Second World War, and it crashed on the 10th of January 1952. The 73rd anniversary is this coming now. It's this coming Friday. Evelyn, where is the plane now?
Well, most of the plane is still embedded in the bog, and indeed, we were up last year, last October 2023, and a lot of sections of the aluminium of the plane have been scattered, have come up from the bog.
Oh, has it? Okay.
Come up the bog. Now, actually, I held it up to myself. It was about 5 foot by 3 foot, quite a big piece.
Yeah.
And quite clearly, you could see it was part of the outer part of the plane.
Okay.
And heavier parts too, like somebody said, it was part of cabaret or on parts of different things, just scattered around. A local person said, because the weather was so warm over the past year or two, that the bog is pushing up what doesn't belong to it.
Isn't that fascinating?
So I don't know whether in time the plane will come up.
And Evelyn, what was it like for you to see the remains of the plane where your aunt had perished?
Well, it was actually very disturbing to see such big pieces.
Yeah.
To see such big pieces. And to think that the rest of the plane is still embedded in the bog 73 years later.
So you would like that? Are you saying you'd like it retrieved?
Well, I would like something done about it, you know, and there are actually some bodies still on board that hasn't been retrieved.
You're adamant there are human remains there.
Oh, yes, there are. That we know of, there are three, and two of the people I know were there that time with us. They were born posthumously after the crash, and their fathers.
Right, their father had perished.
Yes. Yes, their father has perished, and
so that to me would solidify the argument for making some effort to retrieve if it is sacred ground where people.
Well, it is. Yeah. Now, it was consecrated, you know, sometime after that the ground around has been consecrated.
Very good. Okay.
You know, at least that.
Okay, there's more coming in on this, and I'll talk to you about the actual climb in that moment as well. But Eamon Farrell has contacted us. Eamon, Joe at RT.ie.
Yes.
Eamon, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. Your connection with this tragedy.
Yeah, so my father was Edward Farrell. Edward passed away about 10 years ago. But my dad had been working in Manchester, and he grew up as neighbours of the Beltons. So himself and Mike Murray travelled from Manchester down to Wales after the accident, just to provide a kind of a guard of honour as the body was being loaded on the plane to go back to Ireland. He always spoke about it as a terrible tragedy. Sort of affected him a lot. It was a big thing for us locally.
So your father
carried the remains onto the plane, actually. Eddie Farrell and P. Malooly, John Hines and Mike Murray, the four Rathcline men, carried the remains onto the plane.
Isn't that a beautiful gesture?
Yes.
They travelled over to bring her home.
Yes.
It is,
And did your father talk about it much, Eamon?
He did, yes. It was I suppose they were the friends of his childhood, the Beltons next door, so it was a big thing for him.
And the Beltons were a well-known family, weren't they? Luke Belton was a publican in the TD, I remember. Paddy Belton also, I think he was Lord Mayor of Dublin on one occasion. Eamon, were you aware that with climate change and the passing of time that the what was that beautiful phrase you used, Evelyn? The bog is giving up what it doesn't own.
What doesn't belong in the bog.
What doesn't belong in the bog.
Yeah, yeah.
No, I'm afraid I didn't know that. I don't think that's well known. It wasn't hadn't been reported in the story, so sort of it's interesting. It does make
actually,
a very solemn sight.
It was just in 2023, actually, there are some photos of myself holding that piece of the aircraft.
The plane, yeah. And there are people still, remains still in there. So.
Yes, there are.
Okay. Stay with us, Eamon and Evelyn, because more people want to talk as well. And I'm very conscious also, Evelyn, as well. People are obviously the South Korean horror 2 weeks ago at the airport when the plane ploughed into that concrete. I didn't think it was concrete. I think they thought it was clay. That might the plane. Ploughed into that concrete and disintegrated with only two people who were sitting at the back who survived. And also I'm very conscious that the big Lockerbie drama is on, I think, Sky at the minute with Colin Firth as John Scotland, Swain. Yes. So and again,
every plane crash or every crash
brings
back memories
of course.
To all those people involved, all those families.
Okay, we're talking about the DC-3, the Dakota plane crash, 1952, Aer Lingus, the Saint Kevin. I'll refer to people's names after this, because their anniversary is 2 days away. Joe at rt.ie 51551.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe at rt.ie. We're talking about an Aer Lingus plane crash, 1952, this coming Friday. It happened and 23 people were killed. The pilot was Captain J.R. Cohan from Dublin, Force Officer W.A. Newman, and Deirdre Sutton was the air hostess. Deirdre was only 23 years of age, from Rendlin, Dublin. Other victims, Captain Michael Laker, who was an Aer Lingus pilot, but he was on the plane with his wife, whose name is not given here, and his daughter Melody, who was 4. And apparently the only thing found intact afterwards was a child's shoe and a doll belonging to Melody. William Good, 36, Mr. and Mrs. Neville Aston of Milltown, Dublin, Dr. James Gaffney of Talca Lodge in Finglas, Lily Venman of 16, who was a German girl coming to Dublin to live with her grandmother in Mountjoy Street. Arthur Whiteside was from Rathfarnham. He was 44. Henry Richardson was Mount Marion. He was 39. He was with Cavendish's Furniture Company. We all remember that. Ed Stone was 22. He was a medical student from South Africa going back to the Royal College of Surgeons after Christmas. Gerald Towney Fitzgerald was from Orwell Road in Rathgar. He was an ex-army officer and a businessman. Thomas Carroll, 48. Was originally from Corporate, living in Long Island, and he was coming over to visit his mother. John Francis Stockpool was 33, from Kildare in Cork, taxi driver, well-known greyhound breeder and farmer. Joan Kiley was from Rathmines in Dublin, and she was working in London at the time in St. Bartholomew's Hospital. Phyllis Noakes was an English civil servant. John Benson, Phyllis was 32. John Benson, 24, was a music student at the Royal Irish Academy, and he lived in Drumcondra in Dublin. William Arthur Lynch was an engineer from New York. Dan O'Donovan, who we refer to as a retired doctor, who lived at Kimmage Road. And then finally in this list, Evelyn Belton. And we've been speaking to Evelyn Belton, the namesake and the niece. Evelyn was 26 of Summerhill Parade, and it says in her, the obituary list here, she was a sister of the publican Luke Belton and first cousin of Alderman J. Belton, a former Lord Mayor of Dublin. Now, Gillian Van Turnhout is well known as a centre and indeed a children's rights campaigner. There is a name in there, Gillian, I'm told, that you were related to.
Absolutely. My great uncle, John Francis Stackpool, of Kildare, County Cork. He was on that flight. He was never supposed to be on it. But his sisters, when they heard on the radio, when they were in Cork, you know, living in Cork County, Cork City at the time, they heard about the crash on the radio, didn't know their brother was on the flight. And it was only in the next few days when the names mm-hmm. appeared in the papers, they found out about their brother, who they really loved, and he was charming by all accounts.
And just reading from the list, John Francis Stockpool, 33, Kildarrery, County Cork, taxi driver, farmer, and a well-known greyhound breeder. Why was he not supposed to be on the flight? Do you know, Gillian?
Yes, we do, because his friend Thomas Carroll was home visiting his mother in Kildarrery. So that's where, like, Thomas Carroll's mother was. And his mother was, it was his mother's 90th birthday. Ah. And his mother asked Thomas Carroll to go to England and find his sister, who had left Ireland during the Civil War. Okay. And so Thomas asked John Francis to drive him to Dublin, which he did. They stayed overnight in the Gresham Hotel. John was really clear, I'm not going on any plane with you. And apparently Thomas Carroll bought some extra shirts for John Francis, and they were on the flight. So they went to England to find the sister. We don't know. Did they ever find her or not? Because unfortunately, they died on the return flight. So his poor mother, Thomas's mother, never found out.
And who was the companion of John Francis that was on?
So John Francis Stackpool was travelling with Thomas Carroll, the hotelier.
Ah, Thomas Carroll, I have him down here. Who was 48, originally from Cork, living in Long Island, who was visiting his mother.
So he
but
was
you
from
say
his
he,
mother.
The two of them were on an errand of mercy.
Yeah, they were on an errand. They were trying to find Thomas's sister
before,
and his mother's wish.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, good God.
She had left during the Civil War. She had kissed a British soldier and apparently got banished. And
I don't believe you.
You know, so there was a history there. So they were trying to, you know, find the answer for the mother.
Oh, good God. And she was elderly, obviously, and she wanted to know before.
She just wanted to know her daughter. Where was her daughter? And, you know, I know, like, my mum, Jenny Hassett, has been over to Wales with Gavin Walsh and gone and visited the grave. And you know, I mean, they've been to the numerous commemorations. But I do know that they, you know, they only identified John Francis by his shirt and his coat. And that was like just the remnants were there.
So
he's in that grave in Carnarvon.
Oh, is he okay?
Which apparently the locals call it the Giant's Grave. Mm. So the locals, that's what they call it in the graveyard. Okay.
And is Thomas Carroll buried there as well, I wonder, Gillian?
Thomas, I have the names of the people who are buried there because I actually have the gravestone. So it's Neville G. Aston, Rosalind Aston, Thomas Carroll, William N. Good, James Keohane, Dorothy Laker, Melody Laker, William Lynch, Daniel O'Donovan, John Francis Stackpool, Emile Stone and Lily Wenman.
Okay, well done.
And they're all buried in that grave.
Yeah. And were you aware, Gillian, that the bog is giving up what doesn't belong to it? The plane seems to be the wreckage of the plane.
I didn't realise that. I had heard that people in odd time had found bits. So absolutely, you know, it probably is nature showing, you know. But like I know it was really very difficult for John Francis' sisters at the time, both Maureen and Agnes, you know, they only found out days afterwards.
Well, he sounds like a character in that he was a taxi driver, a farmer. That's what brought him to Dublin with
Thomas. He did his dog training. He was a man of many talents and he was very well liked. And according, like my mum would say that her mother, like he was a beloved brother. Like they adored him. And my mum's family would have had a tough enough time growing up. And he would always be sending them things and looking out for them. And, you know, so they lost that, you know, that angel that they had in their life.
And do we know what persuaded him? Remember, you said to me, I'm not getting on a plane.
Yeah.
But I presume the camaraderie of the journey up and they got to know each other if they didn't.
Each other, stay overnight in the Gresham, you have your friends, you know. I'm sure he just said, come on,
we go,
You know, I can just imagine the conversation, but, you know, That's why the sisters never thought he'd be on that flight. Like it just didn't even, when they heard of the crash, it was, oh, that's awful. But never thought that they could have any connection.
Yeah. I don't know, was he just, well, it was 1952, not many people had flown. But had he a fear of flying or was it just?
I have no idea.
Did he get it? You know the way people get it? premonition?
I have no idea what, but you know, he probably said, "Look, I'll bring you to Dublin and away with you then," or whatever. But I have no idea. I just know I always grew up with understanding about that crash, and I always felt it got airbrushed out of so many stories. Like even when, you know, Aer Lingus would talk and people would reference the crash, it never got referenced.
Yeah, that's so
it's great that you're giving it attention.
And that's thanks to the relatives, by the way, and including yourself.
Yeah.
From Aer Lingus' statement, we asked him three questions. What does Aer Lingus say or believe was the cause of the crash? Did Aer Lingus pay compensation at the time to the survivors? To the families of the deceased, and did Aer Lingus pay for the plaque, which apparently they did, currently at the crash site. Now, the statement from Aer Lingus is, given the passage of time, Aer Lingus is not in a position to comment, but acknowledges that this is a sensitive time for the families as the anniversary approaches. What do you think of that statement, Evelyn? Evelyn Belton.
They're not committing themselves to anything, are they?
No. Well, there was other people, other Irish people involved in the rescue. The crash happened, the locals, and again, I'm thinking of Lockerbie, and I'm thinking, Lockerbie happened at 7.50, or sorry, it might have been around the same time, just after 7 in the evening, which is when the Lockerbie plane disintegrated with the explosion, and the locals thought the world was coming to an end when fire rained from the skies and bodies. It's incredibly vividly done in the first episode of, Colin Firth, the drama starring Colin Firth. But locals at around 7:10, they heard an aircraft overhead. Then they heard the sound of a crash and saw a big glow in the sky near the mountains. Police and scores of RAF men and soldiers were involved that night in the torturous rescue mission in torrential rain. Among them were two Irishmen, senior air craftsman Willie Redmond of Cabra in Dublin and senior air craftsman Christopher McCran of Sligo, who were both in the RAF. By midnight, and remember the horrific weather conditions, it was this week up the mountains in Wales, by midnight about 100 helpers were directed to the desolate mountain bog, and they worked by torchlight to extricate as many bodies as they could from the wreckage and the bog. Wow. It is and Eamon, I know you spoke about your father Eddie travelling over and that beautiful image of the four friends of Evelyn's family escorting in the guard of honour basically and escorting her remains home. Did they actually get to visit the site of the crash, I wonder, Eamon? Did your dad?
I don't think so, no. My dad was working in Manchester at the time, so they just travelled down to Wales, but I don't think they ever made it up to the mountain.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in visiting myself, but okay. I really...
And what is... Let's hear from Evelyn, if we can. Evelyn, what is the journey like to get to the wreckage?
Well, it's a difficult journey, and it will take a...
Well, where's the nearest village or town or...
I wouldn't be able to get that offhand. When we went over there, we actually stayed in the hotel where the search went from. Like, it's still there and still run by the same family.
Okay.
You know, and as that other lady said, when they went over, we all met in that hotel and we all stayed in that hotel.
Okay. And then how long
and went from that hotel up the mountain. And it was probably an hour and a half. When you knew where you were going, you needed a guide or needed somebody. You just wouldn't go because it's barren and you go up. So it's steep, quite steep and quite difficult some of the way. And then it levels off for a while and it's quite boggy and quite wet. So you would need a stick and good footwear. Like, it is quite a difficult trek.
And you need to be... And many were in your group when you went up, Evelyn?
Oh, there might have been 25, maybe 20. You know, a lot of relatives.
That was good.
There might have been 6 or 7, we'll say, representative from the Belton family the last time we went. Different relations. My sister and my first cousin, Mary, in Dublin, Luke's daughter. And other cousins then came from Sligo and Limerick and different parts of the country.
And if you send, if we have those photographs, because I know we saw a photograph yesterday of the actual stone, the memorial. I just can't lay my hand on it at the minute.
We'll
tweet that at Joe Live then at RTE with some other photographs because I'm when in terms of coming up, seeing the pieces of the wreckage, were you expecting that, Evelyn?
No.
Okay.
I was not. No, I was not expecting.
Wow.
Because I thought if anything had come to light or appeared in the bog, I presumed that Aer Lingus would have them removed.
Yeah.
Or a representative of Aer Lingus would have them removed.
Again, I'm thinking of Lockerbie, where the crash site was the biggest crime investigation site ever. It was over hundreds of miles, obviously, but it was all sealed off by by the police and the army, but it was the aircraft investigation. And it's the same we hear now when you hear, God forbid, of a plane crash, the whole area is sealed off for miles around because it is the scene and everything is gathered up and brought to, in our case, normally Gormanstown, with the Aviation and Accident Investigation Authority. But as you're saying, the parts of the wreckage are still there.
Yes, well, last October 23, now was the last time I was there. Yeah, a group of us were there.
Yeah, okay. Stay with us. Joe at RT.ie. Jean McQuillan. Jean, good afternoon. Oh, this is an awful, a terrible tragedy again. The crash is a terrible tragedy, but listen to this story and I'm just reading on the screen. Jean, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Basically the story is my mom was an aristos with Aer Lingus in those days, and it was a very glamorous role, obviously. She was actually the standby aristos for that flight. And so she would have known the aristos who was on the flight very well. She'd actually only just gotten engaged. And they were all very young. Like, I think my mom was probably only about maybe 21, maybe 22 at that time, if that.
That was Deirdre, and Deirdre Sutton was 23.
Was 23, yeah. So they would have been all in and around the same age. And Aer Lingus was a tiny operation then, so they all knew everybody, like all the staff knew everybody.
Yeah.
And like my mom, I've always talked about it actually. It's funny, we've grown up with it. And I'm the youngest of five. And my mom certainly would have like the whole story on that. But from what I remember, Deirdre had a cold, but because she'd only just gotten engaged, it was like, no, you know, I'll fly, don't worry. And I think she'd arranged for her fiancé to pick her up the next morning, because in those days, they didn't fly back that night. They always stayed over.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
And then they'd fly back the next day. And, and I think, but you know, you're young, you're 22, 23, I suppose you're going to say, oh, no, sure, I'm grand, like, you know, and she made the decision to fly instead of not. And I suppose that's where fate stepped in, in a way. But my mum has always talked about Deirdre, like, although we obviously didn't know her or anything like that, we've certainly grown up as a family with the story and knowing about Deirdre. And even though my mum was very lucky that she wasn't flying, it just shows that, you know, I think sometimes if fate is there, fate is there. Which isn't easy on families who lost people. And there were a lot of men who were killed, who left families without any means of support.
Okay.
You know, so it wasn't nowadays where there'd be all this compensation and everything. Like, in those days, that didn't exist.
Yeah.
You know, people accepted accidents happened and, you know, but there were families left destitute from that because they lost their breadwinners or whatever on the flight.
Yeah. And Jean, thankfully your mother is still with us. And
very much
and
so.
She's on the other line at the minute.
Oh, great.
Right,
well, then Mum can tell you more.
Okay, well, Maura McQuillan from Basin Drogheda now. Maura, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
And how are you?
I'm fine.
Okay.
Absolutely fine. You bring me back my memories now.
Yeah.
For all that long time ago. But flight was, there were 20 passengers on, as you know, and three crew.
Yeah.
Because we only flew DC-3s. So the capacity was 28 passengers.
Okay.
So it was really very small. And the company at that stage was really very small too.
Yeah.
Everybody knew everybody in those days. It was completely different.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I was standby for that flight that afternoon. And Deirdre had just got engaged and she was excited and everything like that. Anyway, off she went, and she had a cold, but she said no, she was going to go.
Okay.
And off she went and never came back. And that was the way it was. But it was very sad at the time, obviously, because it was the first of the crashes, if you like.
Yeah.
Commercial crashes, put it like that.
And how did you hear about the tragedy, Maura?
I got a phone call from operations. I went home, obviously, when the flight. I had a couple of flights for the afternoon. And I went home, and I got a phone call from operations. My memory, if I said about 10 o'clock at night.
Okay.
To tell me. And at that stage, obviously, it hadn't come out in the news at that stage, you know.
Yeah.
But it was quite a shock. And actually, I was on a London flight the next morning, and they amalgamated two London flights to one. Mm-hmm. So I was on hostess on that flight. So it was quite emotional.
Of course.
I can tell you, at the time.
And did you, would you have flown to Northolt Airport, as it was called at the time? Or?
Well, we flew into Northolt in those days.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't fly into Heathrow.
Of course, yeah. So you would have gone over the same flight path.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Oh, my God.
So it was quite strange, really, when you think about it.
And Maura, there was 20 passengers, two pilots, and there was only one crew. Should there not have been two? God forbid, but thankfully there wasn't. But one person looked after the 20 people, is that it?
Who? What?
The Deirdre, or could have been yourself. Your job was to look after all the passengers. You were on your own in that job.
We were on our own,
yes.
We were on our own. But we didn't have trolleys now or anything like that in those days.
Okay.
It was very different.
Yeah, and what was that plane like, Maura, the DC-3?
Well, we didn't fly very high in the sky either.
Okay, it wasn't pressurised.
But it was always very exciting in those days, I must say.
Yeah.
And we managed. We managed really well.
Was it
we only flew to the UK, you must remember.
Yeah. Okay.
And then we only flew to Paris and Amsterdam.
Yeah.
So it took a while for the airline, if you like, to grow.
Of course, yeah, and a lot of DC-3s were bought after the Second World War. And Maura, like, was it a noisy aircraft? Was it a comfortable aircraft? Was it a cold aircraft?
Oh yes, it was.
Yeah.
Now I suppose, if you like, it was very small, obviously, but and you only had two people sitting together. You didn't have threes and all that kind
of
thing, you know.
Okay.
It was very easy to walk up and down an aisle, but we didn't do an awful lot of walking up and down the aisle in those days, I can tell you. Because we very rarely had a really full flight, if you know what I mean.
Okay.
People didn't fly that much in those days.
Yeah.
Because they say that it was expensive. Now, whether it was or wasn't, I can't really remember, because you know yourself. Everything is relative.
Yeah, everything is relative. And Maura, do you remember Deirdre's funeral?
Oh, I do. She was a lovely girl. She was a blonde girl. And she lived in Ranelagh.
Yeah.
In Dublin.
And I presume, as you say, it was
all knew each other quite well, Joe. Because there were only about 35 girls there at the time.
Yeah, it was Aer Lingus Chonta, as it was known then. It had only been relatively recently been established. And would most of the 35 hostesses, I presume, depending on roster, would have been at the funeral.
We got to know each other quite well.
Yeah.
We got to know the different, staff, if you'd like to call them that, and different outstations, if you know what I mean. So it was all very different. It was all very easy.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't as commercialised as it is now,
course,
if you like to put it like that.
And I presume, Maura, it wasn't as hectic
Pardon?
It wasn't as hectic in terms of thousands of people in Dublin Airport going from A to B. And
well, it was very small because
yes.
it was called Collinstown.
Collinstown, yeah.
And it was really very small, and they had the restaurant there with, I forget the manager's name now, but anyway,
that's
it doesn't matter. But they had dinner dances on a Saturday night and that kind of thing, you know. It was all very small.
And Maura, how were you about flying the next day?
Well, that wasn't easy, but it had to be done, obviously.
Did you?
And everything had to go as planned.
But you were
and,
very... You were
they amalgamated two flights. We always had two flights together in the morning. And I think they still have those two flights going. And they amalgamated the two into one.
Okay. But were you...
Now, I have to say,
yes.
When we got to London and when we got to Northolt, everybody was really good and very nice. And, of course, we had passengers coming back.
Yeah. And do you remember?
Coming back, so they were in the same situation, if you like.
Yeah, but you would have been okay when you came from Dublin to London, and then you flew back to Dublin
back to London
from Northolt.
Yes. Yeah. But you must remember, Joe, it was 2 hours to go to London, then and 2 hours back.
And when you were flying either over or back on that morning, which was.
9 o'clock in the morning.
So it was less than, 14 hours after the tragedy. Did you, and forgive me for this question now, Maura, but did the passengers look out the window and try and see what had happened?
No, they didn't. I don't remember really what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, there was no big, difficulty about it.
Yeah. Oh my God! On the anniversary is this coming weekend? This coming
tomorrow,
Friday.
I think.
Yeah,
is it Friday?
Friday,
the 10th.
Yeah. And do you remember what the weather was like on that Friday? Well, you were
the weather
Dublin.
Wasn't great.
Yeah,
wasn't great.
Bit like now, I suppose.
What
it was
at
the beginning
of
January. Yeah.
It could have been raining for all I know now, but it wasn't great because obviously at this time of the year, you know yourself, it comes and goes the weather.
And how long did you stay flying with Aer Lingus after that, Maura?
I got married in 1955.
Okay. And was that because you were in a public body? Did you have to leave? Was the marriage ban?
Oh, yes, we had
public
to leave
bodies
in those
there,
days.
Yeah.
We didn't. I think married women couldn't go back until about 1972, 73.
It was primarily in civil service and public companies, private companies.
Exactly.
What a
but it didn't matter, really, because. That's the way it was.
Yeah. Okay.
If you know what I mean.
Well, God rest Deirdre Sutton and indeed the other 22 who passed away. Deirdre was from Ranelagh. I didn't know she was engaged and she wanted to go to meet her fiancé. Her family ran a grocery shop in Ranelagh in Dublin. Maura, it's great to hear your voice. And I've met someone over Christmas who has a fear of flying.
Well, it was interesting to get to hear it on the radio because it has never been brought up before. All the conversation about Aer Lingus seems to start about 1957.
Yeah, and then there was a crash in Shannon.
Fact,
and then there was
it really started a long time before that.
Yes.
And it was interesting times in those days, you know.
Yeah. Well, it's great to hear you, Maura. It's great to hear your voice. And it just shows you how recently it's in our lifetime that this awful tragedy. Awful tragedy happened.
It was a terrible thing to happen at the time. It really was. And it was a big story at the time.
Yeah, of course.
And you've just brought back memories to me.
Okay.
Memories and bad memories,
Course,
if you know what I mean.
Of course I do. You were only so young and it was an exciting job and you were taking to the air and obviously you didn't have... And when is the first time you actually flew, Maura? Was it when you went to work for Aer Lingus or you'd flown before?
No, well, I had been to Paris and London and various places like that.
Okay.
And I just saw the ad in the paper and thought, well, that'd be exciting.
Yeah.
And I applied and got in and that was the way it was. I made great friends when I was in there that I'd had all my life.
Okay. And
because we were such a close-knit family, if you like.
Mm-hmm. And people would have known you in Aer Lingus Toronto at the time as Maura MacLeisett. Would that be correct?
Oh, for heaven's sake, you've gone through my whole history.
Oh, you're very good. And Jean, when you were growing up, were you aware of this incredible...
Very much so. Mom would regularly talk about it. And I think more so in the fact that I think, you know, Mum always felt very strongly that it never seemed to have been acknowledged that the first real tragedy, if you like, of an air crash that we were aware of was 1968. But Mum was always like, no, the first Aer Lingus crash was 1952.
Yes.
And would still, to this day, Mum can get a little bit emotional still about the whole thing.
Yeah.
Dirge's, obviously, funeral was very traumatic for all of them. And they were all young girls. And in those days, things were different. Like, women did give up their jobs and all of that.
Yeah.
But we definitely, we all... It was something we've all grown up with. It's a story we're all very much aware, and her grandchildren now are, you know the story. And, you know, and sometimes, you know, I suppose we reference it more as, you know, and it sounds terribly cliche to say, you know, when your number's up, your number is up.
Yeah.
But sometimes fate is there and you can't fight fate. And it's not a simplistic view in it, because there are a lot of families, there are over 20 families out there and extended families who suffered as a result of what happened. But in those days, and the aircraft were very noisy, because my mum ended up having to give up flying.
Okay.
Because of the pressurized, once they got ear infections or anything like that, they were all grounded.
Couldn't
fly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but it was different times. I mean, it was very glamorous. It was a very glamorous career for a young girl. And I'm not saying it's not glamorous now.
Yeah,
the girls certainly work very hard now. But I think in those days it was different. It was the start of travel, and it was a very different. It's something we've all grown up with. It's something we're very much aware of. And I have to say, although, as I said before, none of us knew Dirge Sutton, we feel as if she's very much part of our family in a funny way.
That's a lovely way of putting it, really is.
Yeah, she actually is. Mum's never forgotten her, never. So if her family are out there listening, I hope they are aware that there were other people and friends who worked in Aer Lingus with their sister. And, she certainly isn't being forgotten in that respect.
Well said. Thank you, Jean.
You're more than welcome. Thank you.
And thank you, Maura, for your memories there, and your remembering so vividly, Deirdre.
I'd like to say also, Joe, that the crews were always very good to us.
Yeah.
To us girls, you know.
Yeah.
Because we were very young in those days.
Yeah.
And it was all exciting and all very new. But everybody looked after everybody.
And the captain that
you know what I mean.
The captain that perished was J.R. Cohan and W.A. Newman from the... I don't know what their first name.
Exactly.
Okay. Maura, kind regards, Maura, and
thank you
for remembering that with extraordinary eloquence and dignity. Thank you. That's Maura McQuillan and Jean McQuillan. Maura McQuillan this people are saying there that they remember MacLysett as she was then. Thanks, Jean.
Thank you.
Thanks, Maura. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And we rest that for a few minutes, because we want to see, can we find more relatives of DC-3, the Aer Lingus flight that perished this week 73 years ago. But let's go to Greenland, because as you probably heard yesterday, Donald Trump said if necessary he will invade Greenland of all places, because of its strategic importance. And it's hotted up in the last couple of hours, because the French foreign minister, Jean-Noël Barrot, he said the EU will not let other nations attack its sovereign borders in relation to what President-elect Trump said. As you know, President-elect Trump declined on Tuesday to rule out military or economic action as part of his avowed desire to have the US take control of Greenland as well as the Panama Canal. And as you know, Greenland has been a Danish protectorate for over 600 years. Now, David Penny, believe it or not, is originally from down the road here in Black Rock in Dublin. And are you living in Greenland, David?
Oh, yes, I am.
Okay. And tell us what brought you there.
Work.
Okay.
I teach at the senior high school.
Okay. And population of Greenland?
56,000, 57,000.
Okay. And is there sunshine at the moment, David?
Well, not where I am. I'm in that, yeah, that's north of the Arctic Circle.
Wow. So, now Trump has said something along, well, he hasn't been as direct, and now he's heading back in 2 weeks into the Oval Office. What is your reaction to what Donald Trump is threatening?
Well, first of all, a bit like last time he suggested something, we thought, is this a joke?
Yeah.
Is it a bluster?
Yeah.
I don't think it is this time.
Oh, God.
I have a feeling that he's more serious about this.
Mm-hmm.
But whether he actually wants to occupy us is a different matter, because he's going to walk into a lot of things. It's going to cost him a bit of money.
Did he not offer to buy Greenland?
Yeah, but he offers to buy Greenland. He doesn't give a price.
Yeah.
He doesn't offer a price. Then the other day, yesterday, he said that if Denmark were not willing to sell, that he'd put tariffs on Denmark to force them.
Yeah.
And I've just heard, as you said, that the EU will back us up.
Yeah. Well, it's quite clear with the French. The French. I know there isn't a military.
Yeah, the French
union in the EU, but there is NATO, but we're not part of that. But the French government are saying quite clearly, hands off. If you go near a sovereign part of the EU, effectively, and of Europe, we will not stand idly by. We heard that phrase before, didn't we?
We're not part of the EU either.
Yeah, I know that in Denmark. Yeah, okay.
But we've got special what do you call it? Special treatment. We're in the second category.
Yeah.
We left the EU back in the '70s.
They voted to leave, didn't you?
Conflict. Yeah. It was fishing.
Yeah, over there. And what is it? And what are you hearing from other inhabitants of Greenland? I know there's different, isn't there, different groups, different ethnic groups among the 56,000, but what is the reaction?
Well, they're mainly Greenlandic. A minority of people who are basically Danish, and then there's a much smaller group which are from other parts of the world, including myself.
Yeah. And what is your... do you think when you say it's getting more dangerous, the threat of Trump... everyone thought it was a bit of a joke the first time round. Does that mean people are worried?
Oh, yeah. It's quite clear that people are a bit worried. His son was here yesterday. And,
I saw that, yeah.
He met up with people who would support him.
Okay.
And only them. And then he bribed people to put on a cap, and they got a free lunch for it.
Okay.
That's what I've heard, at least from a CNN report.
Yeah. Stay with us, David. Vitas Kwiatkowiak is a former Minister for Finance, Foreign Affairs, Mineral Resources, Trade, Tourism. I know it's a relatively small country, former Cabinet Minister. Vitas, good afternoon from Dublin in Ireland, where David, our colleague there, and who's in Greenland, that lives in Greenland, is from. Vitas, what is your reaction to what Donald Trump is saying?
Well, before we go to Trump, Greenland has been a Danish protectorate for 300 years, not 600 years, as you mentioned.
Okay.
And we are not being occupied by United States. United States have had a legitimate access for Greenland for the past 83 years.
For the airbase, yeah.
Due to a defense agreement. That,
yes, okay. So are you saying you would welcome the Trump initiative? What's the phone line going? Okay, I'll take a quick break. We'll try and get the phone line back. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Vitas Kuatok is the founder of the pro-independence party in Greenland. You want independence from Denmark. But Vitas, what do you think of the Donald Trump initiative?
I think you need to understand Donald Trump's form of communication of what he truly means. I think we need to put in mind that the Arctic is a very focal point of United States due to an increased interest from Russia and China.
Yeah.
For that, I think United States is concerned about other superpowers trying to gain more access to Arctic. And I guess that's how we need to perceive the message from Trump, that he has concerns on the Russian increase of their presence in the Arctic and China's increased presence in the Arctic. That's the real concern that I think the United States is looking at.
Okay. So do you think there is a prospect that United States, I know you're pro-independence from Denmark, but that the United States would somehow take much greater control in Greenland? Do you think that's a realistic prospect, Vitas?
Well, we need to look at the realities that the United States already has access
for
Greenland.
Yeah.
So I don't see any reason for any occupation, because that's what they have been allowed for the past 83 years. So they have a military base already in Greenland. So there is no further step they need. Okay. I guess it's a question of increasing their military presence that is on the agenda, on how to protect not only the Arctic, but also to ensure the safety of the internal zone as they regard it in the Monroe Doctrine. So it's a question of security and safety that we need to look at how things work.
Okay, Vitas, I just want to go back to David Penny. David, I really appreciate both of you coming up and appreciate the fact that you're originally from Dublin, David. Is there a big American presence on the landmass, David? Would you notice them? No.
No, there's nobody here where I live who's American.
Is there an army? Is the Danish army there?
There is army presence. And of Navy presence.
Okay.
Coastal defence mainly.
Okay.
And the Danish government has promised extra money to upgrade the military presence.
Yeah.
We don't see them very often.
Yeah. Okay, David. Do you think Trump could just simply overrun Greenland? If he says, I want it, he could just take it.
Well, they'd have to get around Canada somehow. I suppose they'd be able to do that without any problems. They could do it very quickly if they really wanted to. Because there isn't really any way of defending ourselves. If they just started landing all over the place, there'd be no way of stopping it.
Yeah. Okay, David, we'll keep in contact. That's David Penny, originally from BlackRock in Dublin. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And it's Joe at RT.ie. I'm also conscious that today is the anniversary of the Weedy Island disaster in January 1979, anyone of my vintage remembers it. The oil tanker exploded, the Betelgeuse, as it was called, it was delivering oil, and the glow in the sky could be seen, and the impact could be seen from many, many
miles away. So thinking of the people who died, 50 people died in this day on Whiddy Island. Gerry O'Connell, back to Deirdre Sutton. Gerry, good afternoon.
Hello, Joe. How are you?
And you are related to Deirdre?
I'm her nephew.
Ah.
And I never met the woman, obviously.
Yeah.
But she would have been very close to my mother.
And I see someone has put up a photograph from the newspaper of her. She was very young, only 23. Was the tragedy talked about, Gerry, in the family?
It was. Well, there was only my mother and her brother that survived. And it was something that was always celebrated in our house on the 10th of January.
Yeah. And as we heard, I was unaware from Maura McLeisett that Deirdre had just, she was engaged, but you're telling us she got engaged the previous day.
I don't know exactly. She was, they were due to celebrate it the following day anyway.
Yeah. And the 10th of January is forever remembered. Well, I'm sure even beyond that. And what there would be, you say, would be marked every year with a mass or whatever, or form of memorial.
The last major event was service out in the airport. I think it was 2005.
Okay.
I think it was 20 years ago. Where there were a host of people there, but obviously we went there as a matter of respect. We didn't really know anybody, if you know what I mean. And she passed in 2011. But they were very close.
Yeah, and your mother was Deirdre's younger sister.
Yeah,
your mother Laura.
Yeah, mom was the youngest of the whole family. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I don't know whether you were aware from Evelyn, whose namesake died, perished in the crash, that parts of the wreckage are, some people are still interred there, not Deirdre obviously, but part of the wreckage are emerging from the bog, and there's photographs around. Okay, Gerry, kind regards, and I'm conscious that the 10th is this Friday and remembering Deirdre and the other 22 people who perished on that, as people said, forgotten by many but not by the families, including your own. That's Gerry O'Connell. Back tomorrow, 1:45. Research, Audrey Donoghue. Producer, Annette Egan. And Ray Darcy is next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. For fabulous ideas and great savings, the winter sale is not to be missed. Now on, in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.